robe, a scythe's ring, identical to the one he already wore. It caught the light in the room, reflecting it, refracting it, but never bending light into the heart of its dark core. 3 times a year, scythes meet at a great assembly called a conclave. We discuss the business of gleaning, and whether or not more scythes are needed in our region. Citra now seemed to shrink in her chair. She finally got it. Although Rowan had suspected this, to actually see the ring made him shrink a bit too.
The gems on scythe rings were made in those first post-mortal days, by the early scythes,
Faraday said.
When society deemed that unnatural death needed to take the place of natural death. There were many more gems made than were needed at the time, for the founders of the scythedom were wise enough to anticipate a need. When a new scythe is required, a gem is placed into a gold setting and is bestowed upon the chosen candidate.
He turned the ring in his fingers, pondering it, sending refracted light dancing around the room. Then he looked them in the eye, first Citra, then Rowan.
I just returned from Winter Conclave, and have been given this ring so that I might take on an apprentice.
Citra backed away.
Rowan can do it. I'm not interested.
Rowan turned to her, wishing he had spoken.
What makes you think I am?
I have chosen both of you,
Faraday said, raising his voice.
You will both learn the trade. But in the end, only one of you will receive the ring. The other may return home to his or her old life.
Why would we compete for something that neither of us wants?
Citra asked.
Therein lies the paradox of the profession, Faraday said. Those who wish to have the job should not have it. And those who would most refuse to kill are the only ones who should.
He put the ring away, and Rowan let out his breath, not even realizing he had been holding it.
You are both made of the highest moral fiber, Faraday told them. And I believe the high ground on which you stand will compel you into my apprenticeship. Not because I force it upon you, but because you choose it.
Then he left without paying the bill. Because no bill was, or would ever be, brought to a scythe.
The nerve. To think he could impress them with airs of culture and then reel them into his sick little scheme. There was no way Citra would ever, under any circumstances, throw away her life by becoming a taker of other people's lives. She told her parents what had happened when they got home that evening. Her father embraced her, and she cried into his arms for being given the terrible proposition. Then her mother said something that Citra was not expecting.
Will you do it?
She asked. The fact that she could even ask that question was more of a shock than seeing the ring held out to her that morning.
What?
It's a difficult choice, I know, her father said. We'll support you either way.
She looked at them as if she had never truly seen them before that moment.
How could her parents know her so little that they would think she'd become a scythe's apprentice? She didn't even know what to say to them.
Would you want me to?
She found herself terrified of their answer.
We want what you want, honey,
her mother said.
But look at it in perspective. A scythe wants for nothing in this world. All of your needs and desires would be met, and you'd never have to fear being gleaned.
And then something occurred to Citra.
You'd never have to worry about being gleaned either. A scythe's family is immune from gleaming for as long as that scythe's alive.
Her father shook his head.
It's not about our immunity.
And she realized he was telling the truth.
It's not about yours. It's about Ben's, Citra said.
To that, they didn't have an answer. The memory of Scythe Faraday's unexpected intrusion into their home was still a dark specter haunting them. At the time, they hadn't known why he was there. He could very well have been there to glean Citra or Ben. But if Citra became a scythe, they never needed to fear an unexpected visitor again.
You want me to spend my life killing people?
Her mother looked away.
Please, Citra, it's not killing. It's gleaning. It's important. It's necessary. Sure, nobody likes it, but everyone agrees that it has to happen, and that someone has to do it. Why not you?
Citra went to bed early that night, before supper, because her appetite was a casualty of the day. Her parents came to her door several times, but she told them to go away.
She had never been sure what path her life would take. She assumed she would go to college, get a degree in something pleasant, then settle into a comfortable job, meet a comfortable guy, and have a nice, unremarkable life. It's not that she longed for such an existence, but it was expected. Not just of her, but of everyone. With nothing to really aspire to, life had become about maintenance. Eternal maintenance. Could she possibly find greater purpose in the gleaning of human life? The answer was still a resolute no. But if that were the case, then why did she find it so hard to sleep? For Rowan, the decision wasn't quite so difficult. Yes, he hated the thought of being a scythe. It sickened him. But what sickened him more was the thought of just about anyone else he knew doing it. He didn't see himself as morally superior to anyone, but he did have a keener sense of empathy. He felt for people, sometimes more than he felt for himself. It's what drove him into Cole's gleaning. It's what brought him to Tiger's side each and every time he splat. And Rowan already knew what it was like to be a scythe, to be treated separate and apart from the rest of the world. He was living that now. But could he bear to live it forever? Maybe he wouldn't have to. Scythes got together, didn't they? They had conclaves 3 times a year, and must befriend one another. It was the world's most elite club. No, he didn't want to be a part of it, but he had been called to it. It would be a burden, but also the ultimate honor. He didn't tell his family that day because he didn't want them to sway his decision. Immunity for all of them? Of course they'd want him to accept. He was loved, but only as one among a group of other beloved things. If his sacrifice could save the rest, the greater familial good would be served. In the end, it was the art that did it. The canvases haunted his dreams that night. What must life have been like in the age of mortality? Full of passions, both good and bad. Fear giving rise to faith. Despair giving meaning to elation. They say even the winters were colder and the summers were warmer in those days. To live between the prospect of an unknown eternal sky and a dark enveloping earth must have been glorious. For how else could it have given rise to such magnificent expression? No one created anything of value anymore, but if, by gleaning, he could bring back a hint of what once was, it might be worth it. Could he find it in himself to kill another human being? Not just one, but many, day after day, year after year, until he reached his own eternity? Scythe Faraday believed he could. The following morning, before he left for school, he told his mother that a scythe had invited him to become his apprentice, and that he'd be dropping out of school to accept the position.
"If you think that's best," she said.
I had my cultural audit today. It happens only once a year, but it's never any less stressful. This year, when they crunched each cultural index from those I gleaned over the past 12 months, I thankfully came up well within accepted parameters. 20% Caucasoid, 18% Afric, 20% Pan-Asian, 19% Mesolatino, 23% Other. Sometimes it's hard to know. A person's index is considered private, so we can only go by visible traits, which are no longer as obvious as they had been in past generations. When a scythe's numbers become lopsided, they are disciplined by the High Blade, and are assigned their gleanings for the next year, rather than being allowed to choose for themselves. It is a sign of shame. The index is supposed to keep the world free from cultural and genetic bias, but aren't there underlying factors that we can't escape? For instance, who decided that the first number of one's genetic index would be Caucasoid? From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 4. Learner's Permit to Kill. Forget what you think you know about scythes. Leave behind your preconceived notions. Your education begins today. Citra could not believe she was actually going through with this. What secret, self-destructive part of herself had asserted its will over her? What had possessed her to accept the apprenticeship? Now there was no backing out. Yesterday, on the 3rd day of the new year, Scythe Faraday had come to her apartment and had given a year's immunity to her father and brother. He added several months to her mother's, so their immunity would all expire at the same time. Of course, if Citra was chosen to be a full scythe, their immunity would become permanent. Her parents were tearful when she left. Citra wondered whether they were tears of sorrow, joy, or relief. Perhaps a combination of all three.
"We know you'll do great things in this world,"
her father had said. And she wondered, what about bringing death could be considered great?
"Do not be so arrogant as to think you have a license to glean. The license is mine, and mine alone. At most you have, shall we say, a learner's permit. I will, however, require at least one of you to be present at each of my gleanings. And if I ask you to assist, you will."
Citra unceremoniously withdrew from school and said goodbye to friends in awkward little conversations.
"It's not like I won't be around. I just won't be at school anymore."
But who was she kidding? Accepting this apprenticeship put her on the outside of an impenetrable wall. It was both demoralizing, yet heartening, to know that life would go on without her. And it occurred to her that being a scythe was just like being the living dead, in the world, but apart from it, just a witness to the comings and goings of others.
"We are above the law, but that does not mean we live in defiance of it. Our position demands a level of morality beyond the rule of law. We must strive for incorruptibility, and must assess our motives on a daily basis."
While she did not wear a ring, Citra was given an armband to identify her as a scythe's apprentice. Rowan had one too, bright green bands bearing the curved blade of a farmer's scythe above an unblinking eye, the double symbol of the scythehood. That symbol would become a tattoo on the arm of the chosen apprentice. Not that anyone would ever see the tattoo, for scythes are never seen in public without their robes. Citra had to tell herself that there was an out. She could fail to perform. She could be a lousy apprentice. She could sabotage herself so completely that Honorable Scythe Faraday would be forced to choose Rowan and return her to her family at the end of the year. The problem was that Citra was very bad at doing things half-fast. It would be much harder for her to fail than to succeed.
"I will not tolerate any romantic notions between the two of you, so banish the thought from your mind now."
Citra had looked over at Rowan when the scythe said that, and Rowan had shrugged.
"Not a problem," he said.
Which irritated Citra. At the very least, he could have voiced some minor disappointment.
"Yeah," Citra said. "No hope of that. With or without the rule."
Rowan had just grinned at that, which had made her even more annoyed.
"You shall study history, the great philosophers, the sciences. You will come to understand the nature of life and what it means to be human, before you are permanently charged with the taking of life. You will also study all forms of killcraft and become experts."
Like Citra, Rowan found himself unsettled by his decision to take this on, but he was not going to show it. Especially not to Citra, and in spite of the blasé attitude he showed her, he was, in fact, attracted to her. But he knew even before the scythe forbade them that such a pursuit could not end well. They were adversaries, after all. Like Citra, Rowan had stood beside Scythe Faraday as the man held out his ring to each member of his family, offering them immunity. His brothers, sisters, half-siblings, grandma, and her all-too-perfect husband, who Rowan suspected might actually be a bot. Each in turn knelt respectfully and kissed the ring, transmitting their DNA to the worldwide immunity database in the Scythedom's own special cloud, separate and apart from the Thunderhead. The rule was that all members of an apprentice's household would receive immunity for 1 year, and there were 19 people in Rowan's sprawling household. His mother had mixed feelings, because now no one would move out for at least a year, to make sure their immunity would become permanent once Rowan received his scythe's ring, if he got the ring. The only glitch had been when the ring vibrated, giving off a little alarm, refusing immunity to his grandmother's new husband, because he was a bot, after all.
"You shall live as I do, modestly, and subsisting on the goodwill of others. You will take no more than you need, and waste nothing. People will attempt to buy your friendship. They will lavish things upon you. Accept nothing but the barest of human necessities." Faraday
had brought Rowan and Citra to his home to begin their new lives.
It was a small bungalow in a run-down part of the city that Rowan hadn't even known existed. People playing at poverty, he had told them. Because no one was impoverished anymore. Austerity was a choice, for there were always those who shunned the plenty of the post-mortal world. Faraday's home was Spartan. Little decoration, unimpressive furniture. Rowan's room had space for only a bed and a small dresser. Citra at least had a window, but the view was of a brick wall. I will not tolerate childish pastimes or vapid communications with friends. Commitment to this life means leaving behind your old life as fully as possible. When, a year from now, I choose between you, the unchosen one can return to his or her former life easily enough. But for now, consider that life a part of your past. Once they were settled in, he didn't allow them to brood over their circumstances. As soon as Rowan had unpacked his bags, the scythe announced that they were going to the market.
To glean?
Rowan asked, more than a little sick at the prospect. No. To get food for the two of you, Faraday told them. Unless you'd prefer to eat my leftovers. Citra smirked at Rowan for asking, as if she hadn't been worrying about that herself. I liked you a lot more before I knew you, he told her.
You still don't know me, she answered.
Which was true. Then she sighed, and for the first time since their night at the opera, she offered up something more than attitude.
We're being forced to live together, and forced to compete at something neither of us wants to compete over. I know it's not your fault, but it doesn't exactly put us in a friendly place.
I know, Rowan admitted. After all, Citra didn't own all the tension between them.
But that still doesn't mean we can't have each other's backs.
She didn't answer him. He didn't expect her to. It was just a seed he wanted to plant. Over the past 2 months, he had learned that no one had his back anymore. Perhaps no one ever did. His friends had pulled away. He was a footnote in his own family. There was only one person now who shared his plight. That was Citra. If they couldn't find a way to trust each other, then what did they have beyond a learner's permit to kill? The greatest achievement of the human race was not conquering death. It was ending government. Back in the days when the world's digital network was called the cloud, people thought giving too much power to an artificial intelligence would be a very bad idea. Cautionary tales abounded in every form of media. The machines were always the enemy. But then the cloud evolved into the Thunderhead, sparking with consciousness, or at least a remarkable facsimile. In stark contrast to people's fears, the Thunderhead did not seize power. Instead, it was people who came to realize that it was far better suited to run things than politicians. In those days before the Thunderhead, human arrogance, self-interest, and endless infighting determined the rule of law. Inefficient, imperfect, vulnerable to all forms of corruption. But the Thunderhead was incorruptible. Not only that, but its algorithms were built on the full sum of human knowledge. All the time and money wasted on political posturing. The lives lost in wars, the populations abused by despots. All gone, the moment the Thunderhead was handed power. Of course, the politicians, dictators, and warmongers weren't happy. But their voices, which had always seemed so loud and intimidating, were suddenly insignificant. The Emperor not only had no clothes, turns out he had no testicles either. The Thunderhead quite literally knew everything. When and where to build roads, how to eliminate waste in food distribution and thus end hunger. How to protect the environment from the ever-growing human population. It created jobs. It clothed the poor. And it established the world code. Now, for the first time in history, law was no longer the shadow of justice. It was justice. The Thunderhead gave us a perfect world. The utopia that our ancestors could only dream of is our reality. There was only one thing the Thunderhead was not given authority over. The Scythedom. When it was decided that people needed to die in order to ease the tide of population growth, it was also decided that this must be the responsibility of humans. Bridge repair and urban planning could be handled by the Thunderhead, but taking a life was an act of conscience and consciousness.
Since it could not be proven that the Thunderhead had either, the Scythedom was born. I do not regret the decision, but I often wonder if the Thunderhead would have done a better job.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 5. But I'm only 96. While a trip to the market should be an ordinary, everyday occurrence, Citra found that food shopping with a scythe carried its own basket of crazy. The moment the market doors parted for them and the three of them stepped in, the dread around them was enough to raise goose flesh on Citra's arms. Nothing so blatant as gasps or screams. People were used to scythes passing through their daily lives. It was silent, but pervasive, as if they had just accidentally strolled onto some theatrical stage and fouled the performance. Citra noticed that, in general, there were three types of people. One, the deniers. These were the people who forged on and pretended the scythe wasn't there. It wasn't just a matter of ignoring him, it was actively, willfully denying his presence. It reminded Citra of the way very small children would play hide-and-seek, covering their own eyes to hide, thinking that if they couldn't see you, then you couldn't see them. 2. The escape artists. These were the people who ran away, but tried to make it look as if they weren't. They suddenly remembered they forgot to get eggs, or began chasing after a running child that didn't actually exist. One shopper abandoned a cart, mumbling about a wallet he must have left at home, despite an obvious bulge in his back pocket. He hurried out, and didn't come back. 3. The scythe's pets. These were the people who went out of their way to engage the scythe and offer him something, with the secret, not so secret, hope that he might grant them immunity, or at least glean the person to their right instead of them someday.
"Here, Your Honor, take my melon, it's bigger, I insist."
Did these people know that such sycophantic behavior would make a scythe want to glean them even more? Not that Citra would want to level a death penalty for such a thing, but if she were given a choice between some innocent bystander and someone who was being nauseatingly obsequious about their produce, she'd choose the melon giver. There was one shopper who didn't seem to fit the other three profiles. A woman who actually seemed pleased to see him.
"Good morning, Scythe Faraday,"
she said as they passed her near the deli counter, then looked at Citra and Rowan, curious.
"Your niece and nephew?"
"Hardly," he said with a bit of disdain in his voice for relatives Citra had no interest in knowing about.
"I've taken apprentices."
Her eyes widened a bit.
"Such a thing,"
she said in a way that made it unclear whether she thought it was a good or bad idea.
"Do they have a penchant for the work?"
"Not the slightest," she nodded.
"Well then, I guess it's all right. You know what they say, have not a hand in the blade with abandon."
The scythe smiled.
"I hope I can introduce them to your strudel sometime."
She nodded at the two of them.
"Well, that goes without saying."
After she had moved on, Scythe Faraday explained that she was a long-time friend.
"She cooks for me from time to time, and she works in the coroner's office. In my line of work, it's always good to have a friend there."
"Do you grant her immunity?"
Citra asked. Rowan thought the scythe might be indignant at the question, but instead he answered,
"The scythedom frowns upon those who play favorites, but I've found I can grant her immunity on alternate years without raising a red flag."
"What if another scythe gleans her during the off years?"
"Then I shall attend her funeral with heartfelt grief," he told them.
As they shopped, Citra chose some snacks that the scythe eyed dubiously.
"Are those really necessary?" he asked.
"Is anything really necessary?"
Citra responded. Rowan found it amusing how Citra gave the scythe attitude. But it worked. He let her keep the chips. Rowan tried to be more practical, picking out staples like eggs, flour, and various proteins and side dishes to go with them.
"Don't get chickenoid tenders,"
Citra said, looking at his choices.
"Trust me, my mother's a food synthesis engineer. That stuff's not actual chicken. They grow it in a petri dish."
Rowan held up another bag of frozen protein. "How about this?"
"Sea steak?" "Sure, if you like plankton pressed into meat shapes."
"Well then, maybe you should pick your own meals instead of grabbing sweets and snacks."
"Are you always this boring?"
she asked.
"Didn't he say we have to live as he lives? I don't think cookie dough ice cream is part of his lifestyle."
She sneered at him, but switched out the flavor for vanilla. As they continued to shop, it was Citra who first noticed two suspicious-looking teens who seemed to be tracking them through the store, lingering behind them, trying to look like they were just shopping. They were probably unsavories, people who found enjoyment in activities that bordered on the fringe of the law. Sometimes unsavories actually broke the law in minor ways, although most lost interest eventually because they were always caught by the Thunderhead and reprimanded by peace officers. The more troublesome offenders were tweaked with shock nanites in their blood, just powerful enough to deter any scoffing of the law. And if that didn't work, you got your own personal peace officer, 24/7. Citra had an uncle like that. He called his officer his guardian angel, and eventually married her. She tugged on Rowan's sleeve, bringing the unsavories to his attention, but not to Scythe Faraday's.
Why do you think they're following us? They probably think there's going to be a gleaning and they want to watch, suggested Rowan,
which seemed a likely theory. As it turned out, however, they had other motives. As the three of them waited in the checkout line, one of the unsavories grabbed Scythe Faraday's hand and kissed his ring before he could stop him. The ring began to glow red, indicating his immunity.
Ha!
Said the unsavory, puffing up at his strategic triumph.
I've got immunity for a year, and you can't undo it. I know the rules.
Scythe Faraday was unfazed. Yes. Good for you, he said. You have 365 days of immunity. And then, looking him in the eye, said, And I'll be seeing you on day 366. Suddenly the teen's smug expression dropped, as if all the muscles that held up his face failed. He stuttered a bit, and his friend pulled him away. They ran out of the store as fast as they could.
Well played,
said another man in line. He offered to pay for the Scythe's groceries, which was pointless, because Scythe's got their groceries for free anyway.
Will you really track him down a year from now? Rowan asked.
The Scythe grabbed a roll of breath mints from the rack. Not worth my time. Besides, I've already meted out his punishment. He'll be worried about being gleaned all year. A lesson for both of you. A Scythe doesn't have to follow through on a threat for it to be effective. Then, a few minutes later, as they were loading the grocery bags into a public car, the Scythe looked across the parking lot.
There, he said. You see that woman, the one who just dropped her purse?
Yeah,
said Rowan. Scythe Faraday pulled out his phone, aimed the camera at the woman, and in an instant, information about her began to scroll on screen. Naturally 96 years of age, physically 34. Mother of 9. Data management technician for a small shipping company. She's off to work after she puts away her groceries, the Scythe told them. This afternoon we will go to her place of business and glean her. Citra drew in an audible breath. Not quite a gasp, but close. Rowan focused on his own breathing so he didn't telegraph his emotions the way Citra had.
Why?
He asked.
Why her?
The Scythe gave him a cool look.
Why not her?
You had a reason for gleaning Cole Whitlock.
Who?
Citra asked.
A kid I knew at school, when I first met our honorable Scythe here.
Faraday sighed.
Fatalities in parking lots made up 1.25% of all accidental deaths during the last days of the Age of Mortality. Last night I decided I would choose today's subject from a parking lot.
So all this time, while we were shopping, you knew it would end with this?
Rowan said.
I feel bad for you, said Citra. Even when you're food shopping, death is hiding right behind the milk.
It never hides, the Scythe told them with a world weariness that was hard to describe. Nor does it sleep. You learn that soon enough. But it wasn't something either of them was eager to learn. That afternoon, just as the Scythe had said, they went to the shipping company where the woman worked, and they watched, just as Rowan had watched Cole's gleaning. But today it was a little more than mere observation.
I have chosen for you a life-terminating pill, Scythe Faraday told the speechless, tremulous woman.
He reached into his robe and produced a small pill in a little glass vial.
It will not activate until you bite it, so you can choose the moment. You need not swallow it, just bite it. Death will be instantaneous and painless.
Her head shook like a bobblehead doll. May I call my children?
Scythe Faraday sadly shook his head. No.
I'm sorry.
but we shall pass on any message you have to them.
What would it hurt to allow her to say goodbye?
Citra asked. He put up his hand to silence her and handed the woman a pen and piece of paper.
Say all you need to say in a letter. I promise we shall deliver it.
They waited outside of her office. Scythe Faraday seemed to have infinite patience.
What if she opens a window and decides to splat?
Rowan asked.
Then her life will end on schedule. It would be a more unpleasant choice, but the ultimate result is the same.
The woman didn't choose to splat. Instead, she let them back into the room, politely handed the envelope to Scythe Faraday, and sat down at her desk.
I'm ready.
Then Scythe Faraday did something they didn't expect. He turned to Rowan and handed him the vial.
Please, place the pill in Mrs. Becker's mouth.
Oh, me?
Scythe Faraday didn't answer. He simply held the vial out, waiting for Rowan to take it. Rowan knew he wasn't officially performing the gleaning. But to be an intermediary, the thought was debilitating. He swallowed, tasting bitterness as if the pill were in his own mouth. He refused to take it. Scythe Faraday gave him a moment more, then turned to Citra.
You, then.
Citra just shook her head. Scythe Faraday smiled.
Very good,
he told them.
I was testing you. I would not have been pleased if either of you were eager to administer death.
At the word death, the woman took a shuddering breath. Scythe Faraday opened the vial and carefully removed the pill. It was triangular, with a dark green coating. Who knew death could arrive so small?
But I'm only 96,
the woman said.
We know, the scythe told her. Now, please, open your mouth. Remember, it's not to swallow, you must bite it.
She opened her mouth as she was told, and Scythe Faraday placed the pill on her tongue. She closed her mouth, but didn't bite it right away. She looked at each of them in turn, Rowan, then Citra, then finally settled her gaze on Scythe Faraday. Then the slightest crunch, and she went limp, simple as that, but not so simple at all. Citra's eyes were moist. She pressed her lips together. As much as Rowan tried to control his emotions, his breath came out uneasily, and he felt lightheaded. And then Scythe Faraday turned to Citra.
Check for a pulse, please.
Who? Me?
The scythe was patient. He didn't ask again. The man never asked a thing twice. When she continued to hesitate, he finally said,
This time it's not a test. I actually want you to confirm for me that she has no pulse.
Citra reached up a hand to the woman's neck.
Other side, the scythe told her.
She pressed her fingers to the woman's carotid artery just beneath her ear.
No pulse.
Satisfied, Scythe Faraday stood.
So that's it?
Citra asked. What were you expecting? Said Rowan. A chorus of angels? Citra threw him a half-hearted glare.
But I mean, it's so uneventful.
Rowan knew what she meant. Rowan had experienced the electrical jolt that had taken his schoolmate's life. It was awful. But somehow this was worse.
What now? Do we just leave her like this?
Best not to linger, Scythe Faraday said, tapping something out on his phone. I've notified the coroner to come and collect Mrs. Becker's body.
Then he took the letter she had written and slipped it into one of the many pockets of his robe.
You two shall present the letter to her family at the funeral.
Wait,
said Citra.
We're going to her funeral?
I thought you said it was best not to linger, said Rowan.
Lingering and paying respects are two different things. I attend the funerals of all the people I glean.
Is that a scythe rule?
Rowan asked, having never been to a funeral.
No. It's my rule, he told them. It's called common decency.
Then they left, Rowan and Citra both avoiding eye contact with the dead woman's co-workers. This, both of them realized, was their first initiation rite. This was the moment their apprenticeship had truly begun. Part 2. No Laws Beyond These.
The Scythe Commandments. 1. Thou shalt kill. 2. Thou shalt kill with no bias, bigotry, or malice aforethought. 3. Thou shalt grant an anim of immunity to the beloved of those who accept your coming, and to anyone else you deem worthy. 4. Thou shalt kill the beloved of those who resist. 5. Thou shalt serve humanity for the full span of thy days, and thy family shall have immunity as recompense for as long as you live. 6. Thou shalt lead an exemplary life in word and deed, and keep a journal of each and every day. 7. Thou shalt kill no scythe beyond thyself. 8. Thou shalt claim no earthly possessions, save thy robes, ring, and journal. 9. Thou shalt have neither spouse nor spawn. 10. Thou shalt be beholden to no laws beyond these. Once a year I fast and ponder the commandments. In truth, I ponder them daily, but once a year I allow them to be my sole sustenance. There is genius in their simplicity. Before the Thunderhead, governments had constitutions and massive tomes of laws, yet even then, they were forever debated and challenged and manipulated. Wars were fought over the different interpretations of the same doctrine. When I was much more naive, I thought that the simplicity of the Scythe commandments made them impervious to scrutiny. From whatever angle you approached them, they looked the same. Over my many years, I've been both bemused and horrified by how malleable and elastic they can be. The things we scythes attempt to justify, the things that we excuse. In my early days, there were several scythes still alive who were present when the commandments were formed. Now none remain, all having invoked commandment number 7. I wish I would have asked them how the commandments came about, what led to each one. How did they decide upon the wording? Were there any that were jettisoned before the final 10 were written in stone? And why number 10? Of all the commandments, number 10 gives me the greatest pause for thought. For to put oneself above all other laws is a fundamental recipe for disaster. From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 6. An Elegy of Scythes. The flight was on time, as usual. While weather couldn't entirely be controlled, it was easily diverted away from airports and out of flight paths. Most airlines boasted 99.9% on-time service. It was a full flight, but with the lavishly appointed seats of modern air travel, it didn't feel crowded at all. These days, flying was as comfortable as sitting in one's own living room, with the added perk of live entertainment. String quartets and vocal stylists soared across the skies with a cabin full of contented passengers. Air travel these days was far more civilized than in the age of mortality. It was now an exceptionally pleasant way to reach one's destination. Today, however, the passengers of Big Sky Air Flight 922 were on their way to a different destination than the one on which they had planned. The businessman was seated comfortably in seat 15C. An aisle seat. He always requested that seat, not out of superstition, but out of habit. When he didn't get 15C, he was cranky and resentful of whoever did. The company he ran, which was developing hibernation technology, would someday make the longest journeys seem to pass in a matter of minutes. But for now, he would be happy with Big Sky Air, as long as he got seat 15C. People were still filing on, taking their seats. He eyed the passengers moving down the aisle with mild disinterest, but only to make sure they didn't hit his shoulder with their purses and carry-ons as they passed.
"Are you heading out or heading home?"
asked the woman sitting beside him in 15A. There was no 15B. The concept of the B seat, where one had to sit between two other passengers, had been eliminated along with other unpleasant things, like disease and government.
"Out," he told her. "And you?"
"Home,"
she told him with a heavy but relieved sigh. At 5 minutes to departure, a commotion up front caught his attention. A scythe had entered the plane and was talking to a flight attendant. When a scythe wants to travel, any seat is fair game. The scythe could displace a passenger, forcing them to take a different seat, or even a different flight if there were no other available seats. More unnerving, however, were tales of scythes who gleaned the passenger from the seat they took. The businessman could only hope that this particular scythe didn't have his sights
set on seat 15C. The scythe's robe was unusual. Royal blue, speckled with glittering jewels that appeared to be diamonds. Rather ostentatious for a scythe. The businessman didn't know what to make of it. The age the scythe presented was late 30s, although that meant nothing. No one looked their true age anymore. He could have been anywhere from 30-something to 230-something. His hair was dark and well-groomed. His eyes were invasive. The businessman tried not to catch his gaze as the scythe looked down the aisle into the cabin. Then, three more scythes appeared behind the first. They were younger, perhaps in their early 20s. Their robes, each in a different bright color, were also decorated with gems. There was a dark-haired woman in apple green, speckled with emeralds, a man in orange, speckled with rubies, and another man in yellow, speckled with golden citrines. What was the collective word for a group of scythes? An elegy, wasn't it? Odd that there'd be a word for something so rare. In his experience, scythes were always solitary, never traveling together. A flight attendant greeted the elegy of scythes, and then the second they were past her, she turned, left the plane, and ran down the jetway. "She's escaping," thought the businessman. But then he banished the thought. She couldn't be. She was probably just hurrying to let the gate agent know of the added passengers. That's all. She couldn't be panicking. Flight attendants were trained not to panic. But then the remaining flight attendant closed the door, and the look on her face was anything but reassuring. The passengers began talking to one another, mumbling, a bit of nervous laughter. Then the lead scythe addressed the passengers.
"Your attention, please," he said with an unnerving smile. "I regret to inform you that this entire flight has been selected for gleaning."
The businessman heard it, but his brain told him that he could not have possibly heard correctly. Or maybe this was scythe humor, if such a thing even existed. This entire flight has been selected for gleaning. That couldn't be possible. It couldn't be allowed. Could it? In a few moments, passengers began to wrap their minds around what the scythe had said. Then came the gasps, the wails, the whimpers, and finally uncontrolled sobs. The misery could not have been worse had they lost an engine in flight, as planes did back in the mortal days, when technology occasionally failed. The businessman was a quick study, and excelled at split-second decisions in crisis. He knew what he had to do. Perhaps others were thinking the same thing, but he was the one who took action first. He left his seat and hurled himself down the aisle toward the back of the plane. Others followed him, but he was first to the back door. He quickly scanned its operation, then pulled the red lever and swung the door open into a bright sunny morning. A jump from this height to the tarmac might have broken a bone or twisted an ankle, but the healing nanites in his blood would quickly release opiates and deaden the pain. He'd be able to escape, in spite of any injury. But before he could leap, he heard the lead scythe say, "I suggest you all return to your seats, if you value the lives of your loved ones." It was standard procedure for scythes to glean the families of those who resist or run from being gleaned. Familial gleaning was a remarkable deterrent. But this was a full plane. If he jumped and ran, how would they know who he was? As if reading his mind, the lead scythe said, "We have the manifest from this plane. We know the names of everyone on board, including the name of the flight attendant who displayed cowardice unbecoming to her position and left. Her entire family will pay the price along with her." The businessman slid down to his knees and put his head in his hands. A man behind him pushed past and jumped anyway. He hit the ground and ran, more worried by what was happening in the moment than what might happen tomorrow. Perhaps he had no family he cared about, or perhaps he'd rather they journey with him into oblivion. But as for the businessman, he could not bear the thought of his wife and children gleaned because of him. "Gleaning is necessary," he told himself. "Everyone knows. Everyone has agreed this is a crucial necessity. Who was he to go against it? It only seemed terrible, now that he was the one lined up in the cold crosshairs of death." Then the lead scythe raised an arm and pointed at him. His fingernails seemed just the slightest bit too long.
"You," he said. "The bold one, come here."
Others in the aisle stepped aside, and the businessman found himself moving forward. He couldn't even feel his legs doing it. It was as if the scythe were pulling him with an invisible string.
His presence was that commanding.
"We should glean him first,"
said the blonde, brutish scythe in a bright orange robe, wielding what appeared to be a flamethrower.
"Glean him first and set an example."
But the lead scythe shook his head. "First of all, put that thing away. We will not play with fire on a plane. Secondly, setting an example presupposes that someone will be left to learn from it. It's pointless when there's no one to set an example for." He lowered his weapon and looked down, chastised. The other two scythes remained silent.
"You were so quick to leave your seat," the lead scythe said to the businessman. "Clearly you're the alpha of this plane, and as alpha, I will allow you to choose the order in which these good folks shall be gleaned. You can be last if you choose, but first you must select the order of the others."
Come now, no indecisiveness. You were decisive enough when you ran to the back of the plane. Bring that formidable will to bear on this moment."
Clearly the scythe was enjoying this. He shouldn't enjoy it. That's one of the basic precepts of scythedom. A random part of his mind thought, "I should lodge a complaint," which he realized would be very difficult to do if he was dead. He looked to the terrified people around him. Now they were terrified of him. He was the enemy too now.
"We're waiting,"
said the woman in green, impatient to begin.
"How?"
the man asked, trying to control his breathing, stalling for time.
"How will you glean us?"
The lead scythe pulled back a fold of his robe to display an entire collection of weapons, neatly concealed beneath. Knives of various lengths, guns, other objects that the man didn't even recognize.
"Our method will be as our mood suits us. Sans incendiary devices, of course. Now, please, start choosing people so we may begin."
The female scythe tightened her grip on the handle of a machete and brushed back her dark hair with her free hand. Did she just actually lick her lips? This would not be a gleaning. It would be a bloodbath. And the businessman realized he wanted no part of it. Yes, his fate was sealed. Nothing could change that. Which meant he didn't have to play the scythe's twisted game. Suddenly he found himself sublimating his fear, rising to a place where he could look the scythe in his dark eyes, the same deep shade of blue as his robe.
"No," the man said. "I will not choose, and I will not give you the pleasure of watching me squirm."
Then he turned to the other passengers.
"I advise everyone here to end your own lives before these scythes get their hands on you. They take too much pleasure in it. They don't deserve their rank any more than they deserve the honor of gleaning you."
The lead scythe glared at him, but only for a moment. Then he turned to his three compatriots.
"Begin," he ordered.
The others drew weapons. It began the awful gleaning.
"I am your completion," the lead scythe said loudly to the dying. "I am the last word of your lives well lived. Give thanks, and thus farewell."
The lead scythe pulled out his own blade, but the businessman was ready. The moment the blade was drawn, he thrust himself forward onto it, a final willful act, making death his own choice rather than the scythe's. Denying the scythe, if not his method, then his madness. In my early years, I wondered why it was so rare to catch a scythe out of his or her robes and in common street clothes. It's a rule in some places, but not in Mid-America. Here it's just an accepted practice, although rarely violated. Then, as I settled in, it occurred to me why it must be. For our own peace of mind, we scythes must retain a certain level of separation from the rest of humanity. Even in the privacy of my own home, I find myself wearing only the simple lavender frock that I wear beneath my robes. Some would call this behavior aloof. I suppose on some level it is, but for me, it's more the need to remind myself that I am other. Certainly most uniformed positions allow the wearers to have a separate life. Peace officers and firefighters, for instance, are only partially defined by their job. In the off hours, they wear jeans and t-shirts. They have barbecues for neighbors and coach their children in sports. But to be a scythe means you are a scythe every hour of every day. It defines you to the core of your being, and only in dreams is one free of the yoke. Yet even in dreams,
I often find myself gleaning.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 7. Killcraft.
During your year with me, Scythe Faraday told Rowan and Citra, you will learn the proper way to wield various blades. You will become marksmen in more than a dozen types of firearms. You will have a working knowledge of toxicology, and you will train in the deadliest of martial arts. You will not become masters in these things. That takes many years. But you will have the basic skills upon which you will build.
Skills that will be useless for the one you don't choose,
Citra pointed out.
Nothing we learn is useless, he told her.
While the Scythe's house was modest and unadorned, it had one impressive feature, the weapons den. It had once been the garage of the old house, but now was lined with the Scythe's extensive weapons collection. One wall was hung with blades, another firearms. A third wall looked like a pharmacist's shelf, and the fourth wall held more archaic objects. Elaborately carved bows, a quiver of obsidian-tipped arrows, frighteningly muscular crossbows, even a mace, although it was hard for them to imagine Scythe Faraday taking someone out with a mace. The fourth wall was more of a museum, they supposed, but the fact that they weren't sure was unsettling. The daily regimen was rigorous. Rowan and Citra trained with blades and staffs, sparring against the Scythe, who was surprisingly strong and limber for a man of his apparent age. They learned to shoot at a special firing range for Scythes and apprentices, where weapons that were banned for public use were not only allowed, but encouraged. They learned the basics of Black Widow Bokator, a deadly version of the ancient Cambodian martial art developed specifically for the Scythedom. It left them exhausted, but stronger than either of them had ever been. Physical training, however, was only half their regimen. There was an old oak table in the center of the weapons den, clearly a relic from the age of mortality. This is where Scythe Faraday spent several hours a day schooling them in the ways of a scythe. Studies in mental acuity, history, and the chemistry of poisons, as well as daily entries in their apprentice journals. There was more to learn about death than either of them had ever considered.
History, chemistry, writing, this is like school, Rowan grumbled to Citra, because he wouldn't dare complain to Scythe Faraday.
And then there was the gleaning. Every scythe must perform a quota of 260 gleanings per year, Scythe Faraday told them, which averages 2-5 per week.
So you get weekends off? Joked Rowan,
trying to add a little nervous levity to the discussion. But Faraday was not amused. For him, nothing about gleaning was a laughing matter.
On days that I don't glean, I attend funerals and do research for future gleanings. Scythes, or should I say, good scythes, don't often have days off.
The idea that not all scythes were good was something neither Rowan or Citra had ever considered. It was widely accepted that scythes adhered to the highest moral and ethical standards. They were wise in their dealings and fair in their choices. Even the ones who sought celebrity were seen to deserve it. The idea that some scythes might not be as honorable as Scythe Faraday did not sit well with either of his new apprentices. The raw shock of gleaning never left Citra, although Scythe Faraday had not, since that first day, asked them to be the life-taking hand. Being an accomplice was difficult enough. Each untimely end came draped in its own shroud of dread, like a recurring nightmare that never lost its potency. She had thought she would grow numb, that she would become used to the work, but it didn't happen.
It means I chose wisely, Scythe Faraday told her. If you do not cry yourself to sleep on a regular basis, you are not compassionate enough to be a scythe.
She doubted Rowan cried himself to sleep. He was the type of kid who kept his emotions very much to himself. She couldn't read him. He was opaque, and it bothered her. Or perhaps he was so transparent she was seeing through him to the other side. She couldn't be sure. They quickly learned that Scythe Faraday was very creative in his gleaning methods. He never repeated the exact same method twice.
But aren't there scythes who are ritualistic in their work? Citra asked him. Performing each gleaning exactly the same?
Yes, but we must each find our own way, he told her. Our own code of conduct. I prefer to see each person I glean as an individual, deserving of an end that is unique.
He outlined for them the 7 basic methods of killcraft. Most common are the 3 Bs, blade, bullet, and blunt force. The next 3 are asphyxiation, poison, and catastrophic induction, such as electrocution or fire, although I find fire a horrific way to glean and would never use it. The final method is weaponless force, which is why we train you in Bokator. To be a scythe, he explained, meant that one had to be well-versed in all methods. Citra realized that being well-versed meant she would have to participate in various types of gleaning. Would he have her pull the trigger? Thrust the knife, swing the club? She wanted to believe she wasn't capable of it. She desperately wanted to believe she wasn't scythe material. It was the first time in her life that she aspired to fail. Rowan's feelings on the matter were mixed. He found that Scythe Faraday's moral imperative and ethical high ground infused Rowan with purpose. But only in the scythe's presence. When left to his own thoughts, Rowan doubted everything. Burned into his mind was the look on that woman's face, as she fearfully, yet obediently, opened her mouth to be poisoned. The look on her face the moment before she bit down. "I am an accomplice to the world's oldest crime," he told himself in his loneliest moments. "And it will only get worse." While the journals of scythes were public record, an apprentice still had the luxury of privacy. Scythe Faraday gave Rowan and Citra pale, leather-bound volumes of rough-edged parchment. To Rowan, it looked like a relic from the Dark Ages. He wouldn't have been surprised if Faraday gave them a feather quill to go with it. Mercifully, however, they were allowed to use normal writing utensils. A scythe's journal is traditionally made of lambskin, parchment, and kid leather.
"I assume you mean kid as in goat," Rowan said, "and not kid as in kid?"
That finally made the scythe laugh. Citra seemed to be annoyed that he had made Faraday laugh, as if it put him a point ahead of her. Rowan knew that as much as she hated the idea of being a scythe, she would jockey for position over him, because that's how she was hardwired. Competition was in her very nature. She couldn't help herself. Rowan was much better at picking his battles. He could compete when necessary, but rarely got caught up in petty one-upmanship. He wondered if that would give him an advantage over Citra. He wondered if he wanted one. Being a scythe would not have been his life choice. He had not made any life choices yet, so he had no real clue what he would do with his eternal future. But now that he was being mentored by a scythe, he began to feel he might have the mettle to be one. If Scythe Faraday had selected him as morally capable of the job, perhaps he was. As for the journal, Rowan hated it. In a large family where no one particularly cared to hear his thoughts on anything, he had become accustomed to keeping his thoughts to himself.
"I don't see what the big deal is,"
Citra said as they worked in their journals after dinner one evening.
"No one will ever read it but you. So why write it?"
Rowan snapped back. Citra sighed as if talking to a child.
"It's to prepare you for writing an official Scythe's journal. Whichever one of us gets the ring will be legally obligated by Commandment 6 to keep a journal every day of our lives."
"Which I'm sure no one will read," added Rowan.
"But people could read it. The Scythe Archive is open to everyone."
"Yeah," said Rowan. "Like the Thunderhead. People can read anything, but no one does. All they do is play games and watch cat holograms." Citra shrugged.
"All the more reason not to worry about writing one. If it's lost among a gazillion pages, you can write your grocery list and what you ate for breakfast. No one will care."
But Rowan cared. If he was going to put pen to paper, if he was going to do what a scythe does, he would do it right, or not at all. And so far, as he looked at his painfully blank page, he was leaning toward not at all. He watched Citra as she wrote, completely absorbed in her journal. From where he sat, he couldn't read what she had written, but he could tell it was in fine penmanship. It figures she would take penmanship in school. It was one of those classes people took just to be superior, like Latin. He supposed he'd have to learn to write in cursive if he became a scythe. But right now he'd be stuck with inelegant, sloppy printing. He wondered, had Citra and he been in the same school, would they have gotten along? They probably wouldn't have even known each other. She was the type of girl who participates, and Rowan was the kind of kid who avoids. Their circles were about as far from intersecting as Jupiter and Mars in the night sky.
Now, however, they had been pulled into convergence. They were not exactly friends. They were never given the opportunity to develop a friendship before being thrust into apprenticeship together. They were partners.